football on off the ball.
It got to the stage where it was almost Olay football from Armenia, and if that's where we're at now, that really is a scary thought.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The news round on Off the Ball
with UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome along to Monday night's Off the Ball. It's Owen here with you until 10 o'clock this evening. Coming up tonight, we're going to be speaking to Eric Donovan from 7:30 to talk about the tragic passing of Ricky Hatton. We'll also discuss matters in the ring over the course of the weekend. A brilliant gold medal in the World Championships for Aoife O'Rourke, and of course, a relatively controversial defeat for Paddy Donovan in Belfast on Saturday night. After 8 o'clock, Anna Capeless and Fiona Hayes are going to join us for a look back on Ireland's defeat to France yesterday in the Women's Rugby World Cup. And in the football show after 9, Nathan Murphy will be with myself and Mick in studio. The Manchester Derby will be top of the agenda there. Liverpool's late win away to Burnley. Arsenal looking really, really impressive against Nottingham Forest as well is going to be on the agenda. So our number is 087-9180-180 if you want to get in touch on WhatsApp. Will O'Callaghan will be delivering the news round momentarily. Will, how are you doing?
Good, good.
Michael McCarthy is here as well. Hello, Mick.
How are you, Owen?
So yesterday afternoon, Ireland played a Rugby World Cup quarterfinal, which should have been, you know, sending shivers down our spine. But this is a team that were beaten soundly the previous week by New Zealand. This was a team that were not expected to win yesterday, and they did not win this game. So everything went as expected. And yet we didn't pay any attention to the fact that this is a Rugby World Cup quarterfinal. So we were obviously going to get emotionally tested and emotionally destroyed as a result of this thing, which it duly happened. I think maybe where the French team kind of thinks to themselves, we are better than this Ireland team. We are expected to beat them. Let's allow them a 13-point lead and let's bite the arm of their main player just to inject some sort of traditional angst into the Irish media.
and they succeeded. Fair play to them. Vive la France. I can't believe the biting. Like I didn't see much of this now until today. I have to say I kind of saw the emotion. Like I was drained watching that match. It was a very long rugby match for a start and it was very tense and I was drained watching it. And when I saw the players to a woman at full time collapse in distraught tears, I had no more left in me for it. I just like turned on the end of the Liverpool match and was happy to kind of try not to think about it too much because it was obvious. I didn't see the biting thing until this morning. I just can't get over it. I can't believe that this would happen. And that a referee/TMO wouldn't take the accusation seriously enough to just say, hold on a second, let's just stop everything until we find out whether this is true or not. Because whatever happens with a high tackle or a standing tackle that's shoulder to the head contact or whatever that might be accused, oh, we'll have a look at it in the background. A biting incident. You know, Luis Suarez is nowhere to be seen. And yet, I just can't believe how blasé they were about it. I really can't.
Is it because of how shocking a bite actually is?
That maybe she just didn't believe it.
I mean, possibly. It's one of those things, though, where when it's not as ridiculously clear as it was, where some players around the situation were able to see this clearly before Sam Monahan even brought the referee's attention to it. Usually if a bite happens, we're talking about the dark arts of the ruck or something that's happened when a scrum has collapsed and potentially was an eye gouge or something that happened where the officials could never have seen it. This was actually pretty clear and was also picked up on camera. So if the TMO had a look, straight away that becomes a red card. It would have been picked up on straight away. I'm a Mick, I cannot believe that the referee didn't at least say, all right, that's a very serious accusation that's been made via the captain. Surely I just go upstairs and say, let's have a quick look. There was potentially serious foul play here.
And it was via the captain after Aoife Wafer had told her 3 times herself that she'd been bitten.
Yeah, it's like Suarez definitely came to mind immediately when I saw those scenes from yesterday afternoon. Are we supposed to be saying appear to bite, by the way? Or are we supposed to say alleged bite? Or are we allowed to actually say what we see?
Opened her mouth and clenched around the flesh of Aoife Wafer's arm, I think is probably the legal term, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure at the sighting commission there probably will be arguments about it.
She was wearing a gum shield, was she?
I would think so, yeah.
Are we calling that mitigation? in the world of rugby laws.
Bring some good biscuits, go to tackle school, and you get to come back for the final if you qualify.
Yeah, if you're going to bite somebody, do it with a gum shield. I couldn't believe it. Part of me that's thinking that it was just too outrageous to be acted upon is kind of replicated in my experience of it. I didn't really know about this until well after the game yesterday evening, and it clearly wasn't a big part of the coverage or an outrageous part of the coverage. It's amazing how something small that might be picked up on actually becomes this massive thing afterwards. But the fact of the matter is, an Irish player was bitten by a French player, but then also the competitive advantage that being down to 14 women would have given Ireland as well. And look, it was probably going to be 13 at that point at one point.
Yeah. It's one of those time zones where actually your experience is enhanced by scrolling through social media while a match is taking place. Oftentimes I find it really distracting, unless something funny has happened within a game. And in this case, I was just scrolling through to see what the reaction was to the match itself, and people had screenshots up of the biting. So you were very aware of it during the game. And precisely to that point, I thought it was going to come up more often in the coverage, because I know Susanna and Fiona Hayes, who were doing the coverage for us on OTB, were talking about it almost directly after it happened, and they talked about it quite a bit post-game on the radio as well. So they obviously spotted it from the commentary position. I'm surprised in the TV coverage there wasn't more of a deal made of it.
Are we putting this right up there as men's or women's one of the worst quarterfinal experiences ever? Like at least in the men's game, there's been a couple of hammerings thrown in there, which a lot of people expected the game on Sunday to be, but then it starts absolutely lashing.
They can be worse in their own way, because you then start to focus on the crisis within the game and, you know, why aren't we turning up on these occasions and all. I'd say one thing about Ireland was they've established themselves as quite clearly the fifth best team in the world here, right? Maybe that's not where they want to be, but, you know, it's a good start. They were 22-point underdogs for this game. Mm. We talked about it on Friday. France were 1-100 to win the game. And I think Ireland have given two performances against France now in the Six Nations and in this World Cup that would suggest that if they're not quite there, they're very much not far off it. And those girls believe they could win and put everything into it. So we've a text in there saying that they threw it away. And we can get into that. Like, you know, as in they, like, they did concede tries. But at the same time, like, that happens over the course of the game. That's what France are built for. It was always going to happen at halftime at 13-0. Playing with a gale and basically trapping France in their 22, I didn't feel like Ireland had enough points. Mm. You know, I still didn't think we were going to win the game. So you have to allow that France got those tries. That was always going to happen. What actually happened then was that Ireland, in the last moments and in the last 10 minutes of the game, were peppering the France line and ultimately had a 5-metre line out at the end where a converted try would have won the game. That's where the character, I think, shown more than anywhere, is that they never let it be as they did against England in the Six Nations last year, as they did against New Zealand last week, as they even did against France in the latter stages of the Six Nations, where the game, they played up to a certain point and then collapsed or then fell apart or then the other team got on top and that was it. We got 40 minutes, we got 60 minutes, we got 70 minutes. They were there attacking at the last minute and they gave absolutely everything. I thought they were brilliant.
By the way, it's one of the most silly laws around, is the one that you can basically have a free hit at swatting at the ball in that line-out situation as France did. So like, whether the referee is to interpret that as it's a deliberate attempt to knock on to try and slow down a play, essentially France know that Ireland have to retain possession on that line-out. So there's no reason why you don't encroach and just put your hand out and try and bat the ball forward, which to me seems silly.
Again, obviously you're going to get a yellow card and a penalty, though.
It was a little bit like watching the early rounds of the National Football League this year, where you weren't quite aware of how impactful the new rules would be, and you'd have these gusts of winds and you'd be like, is a 10-point lead safe at halftime? Is a 15-point lead? And you kind of always had the feeling that 13 was going to be a little bit too slim a lead. If they got to 20, if they, one of those 35 phases of play had resulted in a try, Ireland might be World Cup semi-finalists.
That was the killer. They also used 7 minutes of a yellow card there. You know, that could have been the first 10 minutes against the wind, 15 against 40. Ireland's yellow card was a killer. It led to a try. There was also France's second try, which was the score of the game, came from an incredibly illegal steal at the Irish ruck. Like, so, you know, there was the referee didn't paint herself in glory, nor her team, for the entire game. I think it did work both ways over the course of it, from what I could see anyway. Yeah. But there was a time in the first half when Ireland were on the line in one of our many, many phases, and there was a French girl like lying across the ball. And it's like, I'm no laws expert. I'm no, you know, it takes a bit for, you know, rugby's a funny sport. People see it on different levels. I'm way down the list on that. I don't see the obvious, you know, rucking penalties and so on. And this was like, as blatant could be of someone lying on the wrong side, and the ref just completely ignored it, slowed the game down. Ireland's attack fizzled out. It happened constantly.
More on that after 8 o'clock on Monday Night Rugby. But we just, before we get to the news round, I just want to chat a little bit about Ricky Hatton as well, who passed away at the age of 46. Like, really tragic news when this came through yesterday. And I think everybody kind of has a different sort of version of events in their own head of like what Ricky Hatton meant to them, or what version of Ricky Hatton they can most kind of cleanly remember, or what was their greatest experience of Hatton. For me, it's more towards the end of his career. I mean, Mick, you and I were chatting about this earlier on, and it's the peak of Hatton that really kind of collides with your peak of boxing watching.
Yeah, without doubt. Like, for me, it's, you know, this is a guy, you know, kind of so associated with his home place and his home city. And, you know, that Costa Tsu fight was one of the most emotional kind of breakthroughs of, you know, you nearly compare it to like Barry McGuigan here winning, you know, the world title, and that sort of the people's champion element to it, and how he brought along so many people and how emotional it was. And then, you know, the Vegas fights and him bringing over half of Manchester with him, you know, to go to these fights. Like, there's a lot of people, high achieving sports people, that are very popular. There's very few who break through into that, what you would, maybe it's people's champion is a kind of a glib enough way of putting it, but that kind of icon status that's based around their personality, that would bring 30,000 people from Manchester to Las Vegas with you, because, you know, there's been British boxers who've achieved as much and more than Ricky Hatton in the ring, but I don't know if anyone ever had that sort of aura and popularity around them. You know, maybe Bruno, I don't know. Like, that was a little bit before my time, but that was my sense of him.
He's definitely more loved.
Nobody since then, you know. And there's something just about a person that clicks with people like that, that happens very, very rarely, and it's more than sporting achievement. And Ricky Hatton was definitely one of them.
Yeah. I think Mayweather and Pacquiao were the two best in his weight division of their generation. There's no doubt about that. But like, Hatton obviously had the bravery, even at a time when he was probably slightly past his best, that he still looked to get in the ring with them, still looked to get the biggest fights possible. A lot of focus, obviously, on the fact that his weight used to go up and down a remarkable amount between fights as well. It was incredible how he was able to get back into shape, but yet there was that everyman quality to him as well, that, you know, Ricky would be saying that he was out for a few pints in his kind of off-season, he'd be probably not doing the best nutritionally, and I think people could look at him and go, right, here's a proper working-class hero who goes in, steps in the ring with absolute world-class fighters. As Mick said, you know, in all of the love that we have probably for, you know, the showman that was Ricky Hatton and a guy who could sell fights remarkably well, he was a tremendously good boxer. And I think for a lot of people, it probably coincided with a time when Sky got a lot of the Ricky Hatton fights as well.
Yeah.
I just remember watching a lot of them on, not pay-per-view, but on standard Sky Sports.
Yeah, Friday nights, yeah.
Made a massive difference to the actual access to actually seeing him.
I think so. And I think the other thing is, like, to talk about his star power and all, like, you know, there's not too many British boxers that would be that popular in Ireland.
Yeah,
and, you know, right or wrong, almost, you know what I mean, people kind of like to see, you know,
why do you think that is?
Because it's the same as anything else.
Is it just the geographical thing?
That's what I mean. I think it's the same as anything else in sport. There's a sort of
it was like Chris Eubank being the villain against Collins. It's just like,
yeah, Eubank, Ben, you know, even latterly Joshua and all this. Maybe Fury is probably a little bit more in between and obviously has an Irish connection himself, but I always thought Ricky Hatton just was a kind of a working class people's champion, no matter where, you know, and I think the Irish really embraced that as well. Like, we used to, I think we had Ricky on the show a couple of times, and we certainly had his dad on a couple of times back in the day. And, you know, he was always someone that was just, there was a huge interest in over here, and people really wanted to see Ricky Hatton win.
It was definitely an unbelievably broad appeal, and even through the prism of football, which a lot of us, I think, experienced it yesterday, that has definitely had a lot of evidence, whether it's the Manchester United fans at the Etihad yesterday, joining in whatever, the minute, 90 seconds of applause, but also Wayne Rooney being like his biggest supporter, biggest fan as a Manchester United legend. I think that's probably evidence of how transcendent he really was, even just in a Manchester context. So
also a bit weird that you kind of have the Oasis revival at the moment, and I kind of associate Oasis so much with Ricky Hatton, and obviously both of them with Man City at the same time as well.
Eric Donovan will be with us in around 15 minutes time to discuss the life of Ricky Hatton. He actually co-promoted Eric Donovan's first professional bout back in 2016, so we'll speak to him very shortly. Now, the news round is with UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action, and you're going to start with the football, Will.
Yeah, I mean, Manchester United boss Ruben Amorim has obviously been speaking after the hammering that United took 3-0 against City yesterday. Erling Haaland scoring twice, and we also had Phil Foden scoring the first goal and doing a tribute to Ricky Hatton after he scored as well. But Amorim says he would rather be sacked than change his philosophy. The defeat leaves Amorim's team with just 4 points in their opening four Premier League games this season. The Portuguese coach says his team are improving, but not quickly enough.
Ruben, I mean, it's eight Premier League wins since you've been here. At some stage, you're going to have to accept that the way you set up your team is just not working. It's not creating enough wins, and people are finding it easy to play against you.
Find it easy to play against, guys. I understand that, and I accept. So it's not a record that you should have in Manchester United. There are a lot of things that you have no idea what happened during this month, but I accept that. But I'm not going to change. When I want to change my philosophy, I will change. If not, you have to change the man. So, and we'll talk about that every game that we lose. I don't believe in that, in the system or whatever. I play my way, and I'm going to play my will until I want to change.
Your way is easy to play against, Ruben.
Yeah.
So say if this actually does end up coming to the conclusion he's painting there, where they're no longer happy with the philosophy and they therefore change the manager, like, what is the philosophy that Manchester United will then attach itself to? Like, who is the manager that's playing with the philosophy that suits Manchester United or that works for Manchester United? Because
I guess Gunnar Solskjaer is available.
Well, there you go. So, like, but it feels like they've tried every other sort of footballing philosophy up until this point, especially because the formation keeps getting brought up. And there are a finite amount of formations. Actually, it's probably close to an infinite amount of formations if you're being really technical about it. But in terms of, like, generally conceived wisdom, they've been going along the same path for so long. Something different has now come as a result of this manager. It just feels like it'll go back to one of the previous alternatives if that is the reason why they sack this manager and go to someone new. Now, I think the questions around Ruben Amorim go well beyond the formation. And I think a system isn't down to just what way you line up. I think he's been uninspiring at times this season. And I think that could be a more reasonable idea behind potentially moving on before Christmas.
Yeah. And is it an impossible job? Like, you know,
there is that.
Like, if he's not the man, then they should get rid of him. But it's like what we were talking about with Ireland last week. It's like, you know, it's like there's a reason that nobody is succeeding.
Yeah.
And it's beyond them all being crap and them making, you know, a lot of bad manager decisions. So if he's not the guy, he's not the guy. But it does seem like the more important decision isn't going to be who's the next manager. It's how do they completely reinvent what they're trying to do as a club.
Yeah, like we saw again at the weekend, Rasmus Højlund plays really well for Napoli. And you're just thinking, how is this possible that... And I know there's probably going to be textures who say, well, Serie A is not as good as the Premier League. But still, a guy who looked like he had zero confidence in Manchester United goes straight in, hits the ground running. Look at what happened with Scott McTominay. Look at Anthony last season when he went to Real Betis. These are players who've really, with the exception of Tominay, while Sterling was good there, they struggle at Manchester United. And next thing they go elsewhere and they look like they're a totally different player. I do feel for Amorim a little bit, and I did after the game when they lost to Grimsby as well. He just felt like a guy who is, like, lost in the role right now.
Is he not quite defiant in all of those interviews compared to the body language that, say, he displayed that night against Grimsby?
Oh yeah, he was broken that night.
Yeah, so is this an overcompensation in terms of how kind of, I don't want to say brash he is, but he kind of is when he's talking to the media. He's very stubborn.
Yeah.
And, like, he's definitely believes in his own values and his own philosophy. And sometimes he can look like a bit of a shrinking violet on the sideline. But again, this is like an over-analysis of a man because he is Manchester United boss. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think
comes with the territory.
They caught him raw that night. He wasn't expecting that to happen. It was the worst defeat in United's history by league placing. And, you know, I suppose that's how you're going to feel in that moment. I actually kind of agreed with him when he said on the Friday, the press conference afterwards, it was like, yeah, I feel like that sometimes, and other times I feel like this. It's like, yeah, that's kind of relatable. Like, I mean, we're not all, you know, sometimes we hang up what people say in the media as their absolute only thoughts and anything else is a lie. I think we all feel differently from day to day.
Yeah, that's a fair point. There was one other Premier League game yesterday, Will.
Yeah, another live game here and off the ball yesterday. They left it very late. Liverpool to win their game against Burnley. 1-0 in the end. 95th minute penalty from Mo Salah at Turf Moor. Here at home, we had the draw for the FAI Cup semi-finals last night. Shamrock Rovers will take on Kerry FC, who were the story of the weekend, really. The first division side pulled off a remarkable comeback. 3-0 down, beat Sligo Rovers 4-3, Colin Healy's side, and they will now go to the Premier Division leaders next month. The other last four tie will take place at Turner's Cross between Cork City and St. Pat's. That's a repeat of the semi-final from 2023. Pats beat Galway United by 3-1 after extra time at Richmond Park last night. We heard from the Rovers boss, Stephen Bradley, on Friday night. They knocked out Drogheda, the defending champions, on penalties, and Bradley told our own Ben Symes that they're now targeting a double this season.
And we knew when we came in before the penalties, we said to each other, Ed will save a few. He's such a presence in there. He makes big saves at big moments, and we knew we'd save a couple.
Obviously, you know, coming up to Drogheda, it's going to be a tough fixture. What did you say to your midfield ahead of going to this game? Because I thought for majority of the 90, especially Graham Burke, Dylan Watts, Danham Andrew, Matt Healy especially, had a brilliant showing. What do you say to them when they're going against a side who you know are probably going to sit in and counter you?
Yeah, look, I can't tell you how, obviously what we worked on, but it was they were very good. They controlled the game, and they seen the spaces. We got a little bit sloppy at times in the second half, but in the main, they were excellent. They controlled the game. You have to control the game against Drogheda because they're such a physical team and they're very good at what they do. And I thought the midfield did that really well.
Shamrock Rovers have only won one FA Cup since 1987. We've obviously won the most of 25. It's 100 years since the first ever time Shamrock Rovers won the FA Cup. Is that the aim for this season? Try win a cup double?
Yeah, it is. It has to be our aim. We're in a good position in the league. We're now in the semi-final. Our aim has to be to go and try to do the double and get out of the league phase in Europe. That's what we spoke about in pre-season. And it's achievable. We can do it. We just need to stay focused.
Stephen Bradley there speaking to Ben after their game at the weekend. Now, as we've touched on, bit of fallout to yesterday's World Cup quarterfinal.
Yeah, particularly those two sidings. So Mané Fellow and Axel Bertomeu have both been sided following France's 18-13 win at Sandy Park. Bertomeu particularly is facing a ban for a bite on Ireland flanker Aoife Wafer, while Fellow's siding is for a dangerous tackle. Ireland had led 13-0 during the quarterfinal but fell behind with 12 minutes to go. Scott Beaman's team were pushing for a match-winning try at the death, but France managed to spoil the line-out to seal a last four clash with the heavy favourites to win the tournament, England. Ireland fullback Stacey Flood spoke to our own Susanna Mullen afterwards, and she said it was particularly tough to take.
I don't feel like we fell away in the second half, but obviously it's hard to get more ins with the weather, and we did get opportunities in their 22, so it's about how can we look at that and capitalise on them next time. How can we hold onto our ball in their half, because in the first half we did such a good job of it, holding onto the ball in the 22. So I feel like, yeah, it is hard not to get the point out of the plays in the second half, but equally we've so much to work on, and we did fight so hard for them last few metres, so we just have to keep doing that for the whole 85 minutes.
Yeah, and you came so close at the end to kind of a different result. Can you sum up how you were feeling when that final whistle went, if possible?
I feel like the moments going into it, like the forwards were doing such good work for us, getting them all momentum and really putting us into green zones. Yeah, it's hard not to come away with points there, and even when the clock's in the red and there is hope, and like it was such a good like atmosphere and build up, and yeah, it would have been stellar if we went and scored there and win a game in a quarter final and you're into a semi-final. What a storybook ending. But it didn't happen for us, so just heartbreak really, and just disappointment for everyone who's followed us as a team, and all the girls in the dressing room. Like, we've worked so hard together, and I think everyone at home, we've really felt the backing, and it's been really nice, and I think it has changed rugby for us in Ireland, hopefully, and hopefully it gets going and more people pick up a rugby ball as well, like I said.
Yeah, Anna Capeless and Fiona Hayes are going to join us after 8 o'clock to do a bit of a deep dive on what happened yesterday in Exeter.
Yeah, and the athletics today, really a mixed bag for the Irish team on day three after a pretty decent weekend. But Andrew Coskren is the headline story from Tokyo today. He's qualified for his first ever global outdoor final. The Dubliners time at 3 minutes 35.65, so I'm finishing fifth place in his 1500 metre semi-final in Tokyo. There was disappointment though for Sarah Lavin. She'd squeezed through at the weekend, and then the Limerick woman finished in fourth in her 100 metres hurdle semi-final. That was always likely not to be enough. The time of 12.86 didn't see her go through as a best losing qualifier, while Cork's Nicola Toole finished in 11th place in the final of the Hammer. Also, Aoife O'Rourke is arriving home as an amateur world boxing champion. What a household for them. The Roscommon middleweight secured a gold medal in Liverpool yesterday, a unanimous win against Busra Isildar of Turkey. It means O'Rourke joins her sister Lisa in winning gold at a world championships. Tullamore's Grainne Walsh and Mullingar's Patsy Joyce also landed bronze medals at the tournament, which means it's Ireland's best haul at the Worlds since 2015. Lewis Crocker, meanwhile, says he expects his first IBF welterweight title defence to be against Conor Benn. He controversially won his All-Irish World title fight with Paddy Donovan on a split decision at Windsor Park on Saturday night. It extended Crocker's unbeaten record to 22 fights as a professional.
Yeah, and that is our next item up here on Off the Ball this Monday. We're going to be speaking to Eric Donovan about Ricky Hatton as well. Do you have just one or two other bits for us, Will, from
the
weekend?
Yeah, it was a big weekend, particularly Champions Weekend in the racing. So the Joseph O'Brien Trend Al Refit will be heading to the Melbourne Gold Cup after winning the Irish St. Ledger at the Curragh under the ride of Dylan Brown McMonagall. He had too much for the previously unbeaten British raider Amalok in the race. Aidan O'Brien's De La Croix got back to winning ways, winning the Irish Champion Stakes, which is the big race on Saturday. It was a good day for the champion trainer. He also saddled the winner Scandinavia in the St. Ledger at Doncaster. The world golf number one, Scotty Scheffler, says the USA team is looking sharp ahead of the Ryder Cup. Most of the US team played at the Procore Championship at the weekend, which Scheffler won by one stroke. His Ryder Cup teammates Ben Griffin and JJ Spawn were also among his closest challengers. Most of the European team were playing at the BMW PGA. They've gone to New York today for a practice session at Betpage Black as they ramp up their preparations for the team event later this month. Of course, it was Alex Noren who won in a playoff at Wentworth yesterday. And it looks like Declan Bonner is going to be the next manager of the Fermanagh Senior Footballers, which will complete the set. We'll have a senior manager in every county in football at that point. His appointment is set to be made at tonight's county board meeting. He's expected to take over from Kieran Donnelly with an official ratification. The All-Ireland winner previously, of course, led his native Donegal to Ulster titles in 2018 and 2019. And one of the early senior finals we've had this season so far. 8 points from Tony Brosnan, who was excellent, helping Dr. Crokes overcome the Gael by 5 points to go back-to-back in the Kerry senior football.
Will O'Callaghan, thank you very much.
The News Round on Off the Ball.
With UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate, or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
This is News Talk.